Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to embark on a journey like no other. Welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast,
your go-to destination for a unique blend of recovery and discovery.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Mark. And in this podcast, we will endeavor to create a safe and uplifting space for our guests and listeners to share their stories with sincerity and a touch of humor.
Remember, we are not a glum lot. The Glum Lot Podcast is more than just a source of entertainment. It's a beacon of hope, proving that even in the darkest moments, recovery is possible. Every story we share carries the power to inspire positive change.
So buckle up, get ready to listen, and join us in discovering the strength that lies within every individual's journey. This is the Glum Lot Podcast, where humor meets hope. All right, Brett, this is episode number 33 of the Glum Lot Podcast. And if anybody out there has tuned in and they have not listened to episode 32, you got to go back and check it out.
Because
the guest was Brett.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's pretty fantastic.
You know, I'll tell you, it's interesting to sit there and do that. You
know, to be on the other side.
And interview other people, but it is definitely different when it's your turn.
Sure it is, yeah.
And I've never really shared my story at all.
Oh, you've never spoken. You've never done a speaker's meeting.
I always turn it down because I am still at that. You know, I have such gratitude that I will ultimately cry because I get so
emotional. Crying's okay, man.
Oh, I know it is.
In fact, people love that shit. It really touches people when you get in touch.
Well, I would be touching a lot of people.
You know, the thing about us in meetings is we are mostly, I think, alcoholics are very empathic.
Oh yeah,
and so when we see somebody else with that kind of emotional pain,
we
connect with it,
yeah, of course.
And we feel it. We literally feel it, you know. But what I want to talk about today is one of my favorite sayings: getting out of my own way. Because I've heard, you know, there was a guy who used to introduce himself. You know how people have these introductions for themselves when they're going to speak in a meeting.
Oh yeah,
they'll say my name is so and so and blah 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 blah.
For a while, I was trying to find one.
Mike A, who I think was episode four, maybe three or four, always said, "I'm an alcoholic, and Mike is my problem."
Yes. I actually like that.
But. And so, but, the, you know, there is truth to that.
Yes.
Because, you know, I wouldn't say Mark is my problem. I would say my alcoholic thinking is my problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, my alcoholic thinking is born out of reaction. So when something happens, my first thought is an alcoholic thought. And it usually has to do with fight or flight.
Mm.
It usually has to do with over-exaggeration.
Avoidance.
It has to do with avoidance and projection.
Yeah.
All the wrong things. And that's why people say practice the pause. You know, and our serenity prayer says the wisdom to know the difference. And so that wisdom is probably not going to come from my alcoholic thinking, but it can come from my thinking in that when I apply the principles of the program I have learned, wisdom can come from there. It's talking to another alcoholic, bringing it up at a meeting, finding something in the big book. All those things are sources of wisdom that do not come from my reaction to things.
Yeah.
And so Brett and I were talking today on the phone about getting out of our own way, about when you have that paralysis of analysis. Because our analysis is always, not always, but our analysis is usually going to be negative.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're going to think of 100 reasons why not to take.
Living in the wreckage of the future is my.
In fact, what we were talking about today, to be quite frank with you, was physical exercise.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you can think of a million reasons why you're not going to do that. And a lot of them you think are – you couch them as a positive thing. I can't really start working out until I find the right gym.
Oh, yeah.
I can't really start working out. I got the sniffles. I'm a little tired. You know what? I've only got 14 minutes before I have to fill in the blank. It's a million little things. And so we have to get out of our own way and just take that first step. And it really comes from taking action. That's net really what it's about, taking
absolutely.
Action.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is all about me. And I'll be frank about that because I do need to talk about it because, you know, I am a person of bigger stature. And, you know, it was something I was struggling with today because I know I'm dealing with some anxiety and I feel like my blood pressure is going up and I feel like, God, I'm such a load, right? But I can't seem to get my ass up and do it. And you're right. All those excuses come up. But
it really is about self-care.
Right.
And we really, for the most part, are really not that good at it initially.
But I get in my way.
Yeah, you get in your own way with it. Right, right. If you didn't, then you'd take – you'd have great self-care.
I'd be svelte.
You'd be svelte.
I think I just spit on the mic. But,
yeah, well. But anyway, so that, you know, something to chew on. Get out of your own way.
Don't say chew on it because that means I'm eating.
Oh, Jesus. But today's guest is
a beaut.
Bit of a head case.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. This is a person that I you know, I guess I'll admit it, I'm very grateful for in my life. And, you know, always. This person is one of the ones that's always left to the end of the meeting, and there was a reason for, you know, for the share, right? He's always the last one picked on for the share, and there's a reason for that. What do you think that reason is, Matt, who is also with us right now?
Oh, yeah, Matt is going
to
be our
–
oh, Matt's in on this now.
Oh, yeah. I'm here now. All right.
You're all in. You're all in.
I thought the reason was nobody liked him, and that's because right. Right at the end they had to pick somebody.
No.
Because I was the only one who wasn't picked.
No, it's because the message is always fantastic. You know, this is a person that always speaks from the heart, no doubt, and speaks from experience. And it's very evident, and it was always very attractive to me. Because he was very one of the people that is also responsible for my sobriety, right? So I am very excited to introduce this person. You know, I was the last one that you guys had to get to know, and now you have to get to know my dear friend Mark. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you for having me. I'm just so thrilled to be here. And what is the name of this podcast?
Oh, my God.
And also, Matt.
This is a sneak peek of what we're talking about.
Matt Y is taking my place as one of the hosts from episode one, if you want to hear his story.
I can't tell you how long I've been waiting to sit in this chair.
Matt.
Sit in this chair right here.
You know, I thought about doing the podcast totally myself, ask myself questions and answer them.
That checks out.
You're still thinking.
Yeah. I am. Because you know what people do?
And you're doing it right now.
You know, have you ever met somebody who goes, I know I am doing it right now, who goes, do I like to read fiction? Yes, I do. Do I like to, you know what I mean? I'm one of those guys. I'm that third person guy. I'm going to refer to myself as.
Do you want us to step out?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I can just
take this.
Yeah, it's the self-flagellation podcast.
Flagellation.
So I'm going to shut up and let you guys host.
Oh, sweet. You know, yeah. Welcome, Matt. Thank you for being willing to come on. So what we're trying to accomplish here is we decided through the help of Matt saying, you know, you guys are doing a great job, but nobody really knows who you guys are, and so. I guess it was time for us to be interviewed, and Matt has been gracious enough to step in and help out with being a co-host while one of us is to sit there in the chair and be grilled.
And honestly, it's only fair that you guys get a chance to be in the hot seat as well.
I didn't think it was fair at all, but I will say that, you know, as usual, I put all these things up and, you know, say I won't be that great. Well, it ended up being great, and I'm glad I did it. So thank you for suggesting this. Now, what's about to come, I don't know. So let's maybe check that out. So, Mark.
Yes?
What is your sobriety date?
My sobriety date is 1-2-90.
90?
1990.
I was 2 years old.
Wasn't my first. Yeah.
I was 14 at least.
Wasn't my first meeting.
Nope, 13.
I'll tell you that.
Yeah?
Yeah, my first meeting was July 7th of 1989. And, you know, I'll go back to the start. I was raised in an alcoholic home by a father who was a maintenance drinker and a good guy and pretty funny and was never abusive, but he was what is termed a not a distant father, but basically he wasn't really a big part of my life.
Yeah. So
because
I think a lot of times, you know.
He was of a different generation.
Absolutely.
Correct.
So he never missed a day of work, like most of those.
Blue collar.
Yep. He would get up in the morning, go to work. Him and his buddies would usually go out for lunch and drink. And then after work, he would stop at the American Legion or wherever they all stopped. And he would drink. He would come home, eat dinner, sit in front of the TV, watch the news, and drink and fall asleep in his chair. My mother would get him to bed, rinse, repeat every single day of my life.
But you thought this was normal life.
I thought it was very normal. I thought I was growing up in a very typical home. I had known other guys that were friends of mine when I was young that it was the same way at their house. And you know what's funny is when I was a kid, there was one of my friends, and this is in the days when I was starting to drink. And
tell us about that first drink.
Well, you know, I grew up in a home where both my parents smoked. The first cigarette I smoked, I was 6 years old.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
My mother's not a big drinker. My father was a maintenance drinker. So I think I saw him shit-faced drunk you know, maybe twice in my life. But he always had a buzz on.
And so
I remember there was a time when my mother had left and I was probably maybe 9 or 10 years old. That was me and my brother. And my father had a bottle of Chianti. And yeah,
did it have the straw?
It did.
Yeah, the straw.
It was a bulbous,
it.
Like it looked like a Florence flask.
Somebody help me out here.
Chianti is like an Italian
dinner wine.
Okay, yes.
It used to have this green, looked like a giant Florence flask with like woven reeds of. I don't know what, around the bottom. It was like really, looked like old world shit. Like
really?
It came right from Rome or something, you know. Yeah. But it was, you know, Chianti was a table wine. It was kind of a garbage wine.
It also doubled for salad dressing.
But my father liked it. He liked to drink it when he was having spaghetti. And so I broke into that, and it was warm, and it was grapey. And it had that alcoholic, like, turn off when I was a kid. But I choked it down.
Was it the smell?
No, it smelled okay, to be
really?
Honest with you.
Okay.
But when you drank it, it just had that medicine.
Yeah.
Like when I was a kid, Robitussin. Everybody had Robitussin.
Need some Tussin.
Oh, yeah, man. Exactly. Yeah.
My parents used to have to plug my nose and get that little plunger thing.
It reminded me of Robitussin.
Yeah. I love it.
So, okay.
Just so you know.
So I drank it like shots of Robitussin.
Keep coming back.
That warmth spread throughout my body. And I just remember getting extremely tired.
Okay.
And then my mother came home, and I remember just like kind of laying on the floor playing with a G.I. Joe or some shit, and I was just like, God, I'm tired, you know?
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a thrill to me.
I see.
And it seemed pretty normal because, you know, both my parents drank and all their friends drank. But anyways, going
forward. There was no real thrill or anything.
No,
like
not
that.
Really. No, it was just something I did that was sneaky. You know, we talk about that sneakiness. I love that shit.
And you were one and done? Just tried it and then
I was one and done at that age. Yep. And it was not a big deal. I was more of a like a sneaky, the cigarettes.
Yeah.
In fact, I got bold, man. My parents would be having a cigarette and my mother would put her cigarette in the ashtray and like leave the room to get laundry. Fucking smoke the thing and then put it back. So I was a deviant, you know.
So
I was a pyro.
Smoking lipstick,
I was
same
a deviant.
Cigarettes.
I was a deviant. I wanted to get away with everything.
Every time I have one of these stories, it brings me something somebody says brings me back. I remember going to the mall when you could smoke in the mall, and they had those planters, and at the end they had an ashtray.
Yeah.
I sure would take them right
pull
out
a butt
of
out
oh,
of
yeah,
there.
Just like you.
No,
yeah.
Just to put that into context, they didn't have malls when I was a kid.
They didn't have COVID either, apparently, because
no, I think it was the Black Plague back then. But
anyways, you know, so there was always beers in the refrigerator. There was always booze in my father's little booze stash in the bottom counter next to the refrigerator. And it was not a big deal.
Right, because it was part of your life.
Yeah, and I had an older brother and his friends, and they started drinking before I did. So I was probably 10 or 11 when my brother stole a stash of some kind of crap beer my father used to buy. He used to, you know, for those who are older, I don't know if you remember Schaefer or Peel's keg cans.
Yeah.
This was all the garbagey beers that were cheap.
Yeah.
And my old man, he drank a lot, so he would just buy the shit. He'd buy the crap brand.
Correct.
And actually, back then, there were imports weren't a thing.
That's right.
You know, maybe Labatt's was around. Maybe Molson. But not like it is today.
Oh, Molson Golden.
Ovi
but
splits.
Anyway, but I digress. Ovi splits were around then. Yeah. Miller ponies were around then.
Yeah. Now, were these the cans themselves? Had the modern pop can even been invented yet?
And they
were pull tab?
You pulled the tab off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And cut the top out of your lip.
But anyways, we used to sneak beers. And I remember not liking it.
Now, were you in sports or anything at this time?
You know what? We played. This was back before, you know, late 1960s, early 70s, when organized sports were not what they are today.
Yeah.
So we were on our own. And frankly, looking back, I think that was more fun. We would play pickup everything.
Sandlot.
Yeah. Yep. Baseball, football. We played a lot of street hockey.
Yep.
Street hockey was always my jam.
How about school functions? Were you involved with anything like that?
Just, you know, they didn't have a lot back then. It was like, you know, you had an eighth grade dance. You had the ice cream social.
It was all slate, hand chalkboard.
I got to, you know, I walked to school. I walked a mile to school back then. We didn't
sometimes
have a school
uphill, uphill both ways.
That's uphill both ways. But anyway, so I'm in this middle class family, and everything seems to be very normal. And my brother and his friends start stealing beers, and so I'm drinking them, but I don't like it. I honestly don't like it. I'm kind of faking it.
Mm.
I want to fit in with the older guys. They were only a year older, but
I did that the first time I smoked weed.
I did the old Bill Clinton.
I did not inhale thing.
Well, you know, in that same context, I remember when I was 12 years old, my brother saying to me, "Guess what I did yesterday?" I'm like, "What?" He goes, "I smoked pot." And I'm like, "Fuck you, man! You did not."
Yeah.
You know, and this is 1972.
Oh, yeah.
And so pot was a hippie thing,
you know.
And people were protesting the Vietnam War, and they all smoked pot. And
were you into that, the hippie stuff?
No, not at all.
No,
nope, not one bit. And I was just starting to be introduced to rock music, real rock music,
nice.
You know, album-oriented rock music. And he goes, "Do you want to go with me tomorrow and smoke pot?" I was like, "Fuck yeah." But not because I wanted to get high. I didn't even know what that meant.
Your brother.
I just wanted to do something devious.
Yeah.
You know, and I was down.
Mm-hmm.
So I did.
Where did that come from?
No, I didn't get high. Who knows? I'm just a deviant at heart.
That's just you at
heart. That's just me. I'm a sneaky, devious dude, you know?
Good to know.
You know what it is? It's the excitement when you're a kid of doing something bad.
Yeah,
you
of
know,
course.
Without being bad.
Yeah, like bringing gas to the bus stop.
Doing something sneaky.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I continue down this path, and I don't really like it that much. You know, drinking is not an attraction to me. The act of doing something wrong, drinking, that was the appeal to me, not the effect. I'd not yet found the effect. And then with smoking pot, back then we used to buy bags of what we called Mexican, and nickel bag was $5, and you'd get a big bag of stem seeds and maybe a little bit of leaf, and you'd smoke it, and I didn't get high. And people would say to me, "Well, you're not going to get high the first time you smoke it."
Thinking about it too much.
I'm ready to give up on it. You know, after like the third time, I'm ready to just, this is bullshit, right? And
but.
So my friend and I roll a fatty, and we smoke it in his garage. His parents weren't home. It was the middle of winter, and it's snowing out like a mother. And we smoke that, and we walk back to my house in the snowstorm. And I get back to my house, and I go down in the basement to take off my snowy boots and all this. And I'm 13. And I take off this knit hat off of my head, and it crackles with a little bit of static electricity.
Yeah.
And I take it off, and it crackles. And I put it back on, and it crackles. And I take it off, and it crackles. Well,
are you feeling it, man?
All of a sudden, I realize I've been doing this for a few minutes. And I'm like, holy shit. And then it hits me, and I look up. I'm like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And I look at my friend, and he's just kind of zoning out. I'm like, do you feel what I feel? He's like, yeah. And scared the shit out of me.
Oh, it scared you?
Scared the shit out of me.
Okay.
Well, I can't say I didn't like it, but I was just scared.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? I felt it was out of control.
Am I going to feel like this forever?
Right. And, you know, so I made it through that, and I continued smoking pot. But I still hadn't really fallen in love with the effect of alcohol.
Yeah.
Probably because I hadn't drank enough of it. And as I got older in my teens, I met this girl. Fell in love, first girlfriend, first love. And I was very into this girl, planned on marrying her the whole teenage, you know, whatever. And she dumped me for another dude and broke my heart. And I fell into this depression. Now, unbeknownst to me, I had an anxiety disorder from the time I was about the first time I smoked pot. Like when I turned 12 or 13, I didn't know what it was.
But I'm not trying to be a smartass.
No, go ahead.
But I guess back then, were depression and anxiety, were they these heavily diagnosed things? Like,
no,
I mean, or were you just,
In fact, you know what? People had PTSD.
Rub some dirt on it. Yeah.
People had PTSD. They used to call it shell shock.
Yeah.
They're like, he's never been the same. He's shell shocked.
You know?
And no, anxiety disorder was, you know, at the time, the mother's little helpers were kind of coming into vogue.
Yeah. Well, then it was hysteria,
Yeah, those were pills that these women were taking, like Darvon and all these other drugs that doctors would prescribe. But it was basically people had anxiety and they just didn't freely talk about it or diagnose it. Well, I had it and I didn't know it.
Mm. You just knew something was wrong.
I was just uncomfortable in my own skin all the time. And I would act out sometimes because of that. And so, but anyways, I get in this relationship with this girl and she dumps me and it breaks my heart. And I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle it. I don't know where, you know, I just figure this is the end.
Yeah.
I just feel like my fucking world is crashed.
How old are you? Of course.
I'm a fucking teenager.
Isn't that like, you remember that teenage feeling? It's just like something happens and you just have no
foresight
whatsoever.
My parents noticed my dour behavior.
Mm.
And in that dour behavior, there were little glimpses of rage, Like, I remember I was talking to her on the phone, and I was trying to convince her to go back out. I mean, she basically told me no. And I slammed the phone down, turned around, and punched a hole in the wall. My mother, like, holy shit. And so my father had to have a talk with me, and he's telling me, you know, you're young and blah, blah, blah. But at the time—
You don't hear that.
No, I'm feeling this.
You're just all feeling.
Nothing is going to make me feel better.
And now I know what it means, but for maybe some of our listeners, what is dour behavior?
Just, you know, you're fucking bummed out all the time. You're just, you know.
Obviously, I know it, but.
Oh, because you're a very intelligent
guy. I mean, I'm very intelligent, so I knew it was. But
so I'm in the, you know what? And for the first time in my life, I'm in a very, very dark place. And I don't know how to get out. And I don't think it's going to go away. And I start to lose hope for myself. And I, you know, I'm from a time when people don't reach out, particularly men. You're not going to reach out for help.
Absolutely not.
And even if you do, it might not be available. Back then it was, you'll get over it. And although that's not untrue, if you get help, you can get over it in a healthy way.
Yeah, of course.
Well, so I did get help. It was in the form of a bottle of Miller beer.
There you go. Oh.
And I remember I had a record blasting in my room, and I was alone. And for some reason, this is going to sound weird, but for some reason, with booze and sobriety, mirrors are a part of my story.
Interesting.
And I don't know why this is, but I remember there was a mirror in my bedroom, and I was looking into the mirror, and I started to cry. I just felt so fucking done.
Already?
Yeah. And I remember going to the refrigerator and thinking, I'm going to drink this beer, this cold Miller beer. Maybe it'll make me feel better. And about three quarters of the way through that bottle, I looked into that mirror and I was like, holy shit.
I have arrived.
I feel okay.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, this is the way normal people must feel. And I finished that beer and I went and got another one. And I turned the music up.
And maybe this is
And I'm looking in the mirror, kind of like jiving to the music, drinking my beer. I'm like, fuck.
Now is this?
I think I found the answer.
That's it.
Was your dad pretty chill?
Yeah, I mean,
for the most part.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was a good dude. Like, oh, you know what the term I was trying to think of is a remote father.
Mm-hmm.
He never really participated in my life. He would, you know, bark out his advice or, you know, straighten me out when I needed straightening out. I mean, he was a good guy.
But you didn't see him as a troubled person or an anxious person.
No, he did not participate in my life.
So your mom ran the show.
My mom ran the show.
Okay.
And he was just he was a great provider, and he was from that generation that was always going to provide for his family and do it well. He was never abusive or a problem. He just was kind of non-existent.
I guess I was just trying to figure out what made you think to go to a bottle of beer.
It was just there, and people seemed to feel better when they drank it.
I was just wondering if that was what your dad did it
so
for.
So I'm going to try it, and holy shit.
Yeah.
Jackpot.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time, well, this is my answer. You know, this is great. Anytime I feel like I felt before I took this drink, I'm going to do that.
And when you looked into the mirror and said that, that was confirmation too.
Oh, my God. I remember looking in the mirror, just drinking this, thinking, okay, I'm going to be all right. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So did you just launch right off from there then?
I did.
Yeah.
I did, you know. And like I say, I drank for effect. The taste still wasn't there for me.
You haven't said that yet this episode.
What's that?
That you drank for effect.
Oh, okay. I've said it every other episode. But so I was off. And, you know, back then the drinking age was 18. And we could get into a specific bar where I lived when we were 15 or 16. As long as we would come in the back door, the bartenders knew.
Yeah.
We would have our couple beers. And as long as we were cool, they were okay with it.
Sure.
And you had to leave them a good tip. And they used to have they called it – it was on Monday nights. They would have 10-cent draft night, and that was our night because you go in there with a dollar, you get 10 beers. And we used to call it Monday night at the fights because there would always be fights.
Sure.
And the cops would come, and we'd go right out the back door. As soon as the cops saw the lights out front, we'd go right out the back door. And so it became part of the culture of being cool. You know, we would go to this. It was the bar was called the Southgate Inn. It's called something else now if it's even there. But they used to have bands, pool table. It was, you know, it was cool.
Especially with that age, it's probably a pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet. And you know, also there were those, not me, but there were other kids that I knew that looked older, got early facial hair. They could go to the drugstore and buy beer.
Hmm.
So there was never a lack of beer. There was never a lack of weed, you know. So beer and smoking pot became our way of life.
Yeah.
And you're
18. You're how old now?
16, maybe 15, 16 years old, you know, in high school.
How was high school?
High school, I mean,
how'd you fit in?
You know what?
There?
I was a fantastic student before that.
Yeah.
I got to high school. I became very mediocre.
Were you bored?
I was bored. I was a vastly underachiever. I would do the bare minimum to get by because I don't want to be bothered with it.
Yeah.
I liked learning, but that structure just wasn't for me.
I got you.
And we would get high in the bathroom at school. Yeah. People would bring, you know, alcohol to school. We would drink. And it was like
in the boys' room.
Yeah, drinking in the boys' room. It was not that big of a deal at the time, and everybody was doing it. And in fact, episode number, I don't know, Kate H., was in my graduating class.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And she talks about in high school doing the same things that I was doing. Yeah. You know what I mean? And back then, everybody did it.
So it was normal.
Very normal. No big deal. I remember in our school, there was a girl who was killed in a DWI accident. And it was like, nobody thought that alcohol was the problem.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was more of a circumstance thing. And at this time, you know, my brother's going off to college. I'm drinking. I am still experiencing my anxiety disorder that's undiagnosed. And my thinking is messed up.
Yeah.
You know, and now that I look back on it, it was alcoholic. And so I'm not a very together person. I'm not a very, I'm not planning out my life. I'm kind of just muddling through it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're, and alcohol was you self-medicating at that point.
Oh, it was. Yeah, totally was. Yeah. And that's what I was using for my anxiety disorder.
That's how I used to justify it.
Yeah.
I used to think I had the worst anxiety in the world because I'd wake up every morning shaking.
Yeah.
Well.
With good reason.
It turns out.
But so anyways, and for me, I was, as far as high school goes, I fell, like, my grades were like right in the middle of the pack. Nothing mm-hmm. fantastic. I scored the highest SAT score in my school.
There you go.
I took the SATs high. I think people thought I cheated, but I didn't.
Well, you're a smart guy. I don't mean that to butter you up, but I believe, aren't you like Mensa or something like that?
I am a member of Mensa.
Yeah, aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah. But being academically smart and being smart are two different things.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
right.
I got a full ride to Syracuse University, Newhouse School of Communications.
Nice.
Very hard to get into. I had no problem. At the time, I think I was paying $800 a semester. And my father was thrilled.
Sure.
He
were
was
you,
like,
were you staying on campus?
My boy is going to SU. No, I was living
still
at home.
Still living at home?
Yeah. I did not participate in that school.
No.
I went for 2 weeks and was like, this isn't for me.
Okay.
Fuck this. I didn't tell anybody. I just stopped going.
So what'd you do?
I would leave home in the morning in my car, and I would go pull into an apartment complex and sleep in my back seat, get up, go get a six-pack or whatever, smoke a joint.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And then eventually I had to tell my parents, and my father had to, like, sit on his hands to not beat the shit out of me.
He was pretty present during that conversation.
He was very present during that conversation. You're going back. You're doing this. And so I ended up getting some shit job. You know, in fact, it was at a lumberyard, Brett.
No kidding.
It was terrible. It was me, another kid that I knew that worked there, and ex-cons. That worked there.
Oh, yeah.
But anyways, I bounced around at a lot of shitty jobs. But I did continue to drink. And I ended up getting – and my father was a supervisor at the post office. And at the time, it was a great job for somebody who didn't have a degree.
Oh, yeah.
It paid well. And so I took the test. I got a job there. And
benefits, pension, all that
I
stuff.
And I was working evenings, and we would get out of there, and we would drink every day. We would go out on lunch and drink every day, just like my father did.
Yep.
He worked at the post office.
Yep. Were you drinking with your father at this point at all?
Somewhat, not a lot.
Yeah.
No, we still weren't, you know.
You didn't, like, bond over this?
No. Okay. He wanted nothing to do with me. I wanted nothing to do with him. But, you know, the thing is that I realized during this time is that, you know, I was introduced to Coke. I was introduced to crystal meth. And pot, of course. And the thing I kind of realized throughout all this is I don't really like any of it without drinking.
Yeah.
So, like, getting high, I did not like to smoke pot when I wasn't drinking. It made me too fucking wigged out.
Yeah.
But if I drank, I would like, let's spark up a doobie because it'll feel good.
Yeah.
But alcohol was my bag, man, and I loved it. And I ended up leaving that job and going back to college for broadcasting.
How old are you at this point?
23.
Okay.
And so I get a job, you know, as I'm quitting the post office, people are like, oh, nobody quits the post office.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, fuck you. I'm quitting the post office. There was another guy who goes, hey, I'm quitting too. And this kid's parents had money. He goes, I'm opening a restaurant. And it's a pretty upscale place. And his brother was a Culinary Institute graduate chef. And him and his brother were opening a restaurant. He goes, get in touch with me and, you know, we'll find you work. I'm like, okay. So I did.
Yeah.
And he's like, you want to be a bartender? I'm like, well, I've never done it. He goes, that's okay, you know. So I go in day one, and it's an upscale place and kind of expensive and a really nice restaurant, really nice bar. And this guy teaches me how to bartend like one day. Well, this guy was fucking wicked alky.
Yeah. Anybody that's worked in a restaurant.
But so this was my friend's bar. So we could drink the whole time we were working there. And so I'm going to college. Yeah, for free. Yeah. Not for paid.
For pay, getting paid to.
And it's by the way, are we getting into the 80s now?
Yeah, now we're into 1983, 1984. Mm-hmm. Coke is really big.
Yeah,
it's blown up
go.
All over the place.
Restaurant. Yeah.
I'm a single guy. I'm working at this bar. A lot of girls, you know, drinking every day to excess, closing the bar, drinking more. My boss at the time, up in his office, he had a second floor office. He had a big mirror on the wall. And he hooked up a buzzer system where he would buzz me at the bar, and I would pick up the phone. He would give me his drink order. I'd make the drink order, put it on a tray, bring it up, knock on the door. They'd unlock it and open it. It would be him and a bunch of patrons from the bar, and the mirror would just be chopped up lines.
There's that mirror again.
I would do a couple lines, right? I would do a couple lines, and then I would go back down to work. And this is the way it was.
So at the time, are you thinking to yourself, this is the life right here.
Oh, my God. I loved it.
Well, how does it get better than this?
Right. We would go out and play golf. We had the hookup. You know, this was a wealthy section of town. We had the hookup for golf. We had the hookup for parties after the bar closed. Women. I was going to these people's houses that were so rich to me. You know what I mean? Like at the time, and here's I'm the middle class kid. I went to a house.
Did you wear a cardigan?
I did not wear a cardigan, but I went to this guy's house. He had seven bathrooms. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And I made sure I took a piss in each bathroom.
Are you feeling like you belong? Are you feeling
kind of,
like, are you, yeah,
because
okay.
people liked me. I mean, I was the bartender from this bar. Yeah. I was like, oh, Mark's here. Make us a drink, you know.
Yeah.
Do a line. It was great. And I drove drunk every night, and I never got arrested.
Yeah.
I got pulled over twice, and both times I just – I don't know. I got lucky and the guy let
How's
me go.
How's the anxiety you know? Doing during this?
The anxiety was okay, except the hangovers were intense.
Yeah.
So intense that I would go into work and I would have that shaky panic attack. Mm-hmm. And I would make myself – I was just telling one of my kids about this because we were talking about hangovers. I would pack a glass with ice, fill it with really top-shelf vodka. Stolichnoi at the time was like the big, you know, big vodka. Put a little dribble of Kahlua in it, so it was coffee.
Yeah, right.
And I would choke it down like Robitussin, just like the Chianti I was drinking. I would choke down half a glass, and then I would feel fine.
So now are you hitting the point yet where you're having those – you're making promises to yourself? You're waking up and having those mornings of saying, I'm not doing that again?
Fuck no.
You're all the way – you're still going.
But I am awful curious about how the anxiety goes because when you're mixing stimulants –
Well, I'll tell you this. I was going to a party one night, and a friend of mine said, you want to go in on a gram of Coke with me? At the time, a gram of Coke was $100, so I gave him $50. So I'll meet you at the party. He shows up at the party, and he's like, I couldn't get the Coke. I'm like, okay. He goes, but here's some of your money back. I got a gram of crystal meth, which I had never done. So we chopped it up, and we snorted it. And we got about halfway through it, and he was going to leave, and he's like, I don't even want this. This isn't my thing. I don't even want this. Do you want it? I'm like, yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah,
so
right.
I took it and I did the rest of it with, you know, another person. And it was, you know, it had that, you know, effect where you're not going to sleep.
Yeah.
And you're going to keep going full tilt and grind your teeth and the whole nine yards. But the next day coming down, holy shit.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to have to be hospitalized.
Yeah.
The crash was so bad. The only thing that saved my ass was I started drinking again.
You can hear that heartbeat.
And there's where alcohol comes.
It was terrible. And alcohol saves the day again. And so, around this time, I'm starting to feel like I'm drinking more than my father did, you know?
And you're doing other stuff that he didn't do.
I'm doing other stuff, but it's never really my thing, you know? And I know that in my heart. This smoking pot, doing coke, doing crystal meth, none of it's my thing. My thing is drinking. And, you know, and there's things along the way I haven't really mentioned, like, you know, getting in trouble for calling in sick to work too much, mm-hmm. all that shit that goes with it. You know what I mean? financial irresponsibilities, and I got to a marriage when I was fully blackout drinking, and I married the wrong person. We weren't good for each other. We didn't get along, and that ended. And I had two wonderful children out of it. But fast forward a little bit, and I'm starting to notice that my drinking is my whole life.
Yeah.
And other people, as I'm growing up, are having children, getting married, having careers, and I am drinking.
And you're left behind.
Yep. And I start noticing these things I'm reading, probably because I sought them out, that were like, take this test to see if you have a problem with alcohol. Yeah. And I go down the list, and I did every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. You're reading this in a magazine, I assume?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the internet wasn't around. Yeah. But it was things like, number one, do you ever drink before you go out to, to prime yourself? Yes. Is it possible for you to leave a drink unfinished on the bar? No. In fact, it used to piss me off.
Yeah. It pissed me off when other people did it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, when I was a bartender, why would you order a drink and not drink it?
What are you doing here?
Yeah. But it was everything down the line. I'm like, holy shit, I guess I'm an alcoholic. But I'm okay, So I was at the point where I felt it was manageable.
Yeah.
And I hadn't been arrested. There had been really no solid, problems from it other than I was losing myself.
Yeah.
And in the middle of this marriage, this first marriage I'm talking about that was troubled, I was drinking, I was drinking every day. I was a maintenance drinker. I was drinking every night. It was nothing for me to go to bed with a book I wanted to read and a bottle of wine and just sit there and read that book and drink the entire bottle.
Yeah.
Yep. No big deal.
Yep.
I didn't want to drink beer anymore. I didn't want to drink wine. I turned to Wild Turkey 101 because it gave me what I needed.
Yeah,
I was drinking for effect.
Cool. If you go back to episode one.
That was Matty Wise's drink,
that
too.
That was my drink, too.
Yeah, so this Wild Turkey did the job for me, and I liked it. Mm. And I was still bar drinking, but I was starting to drink more at home and alone and late. And I remember a couple things in my life around the end of my drinking where I would fall asleep with a drink in my hand at like maybe 2:30 in the morning on a weekday.
Yeah.
And I would fall asleep or pass out for 45 minutes, wake up, and my drink would still be in my hand. And
I also had a bowl of spaghetti all over me once.
Oh, wow.
You're talking about me, right?
No, me.
Oh, really? Because I've got a spaghetti story, too.
Yep, that was a big turning point.
I've got a pizza story.
I would wake up and I'd start drinking it again. And the fucked up thing is I would finish that drink and I would go and make another one.
That's right.
And here it is 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm supposed to get up and work.
And you got two kids.
I got two little kids. At the time I had one.
Okay.
I had my first daughter. And so – the turning point for me really came in, I remember it was a beautiful summer day and my daughter was a baby and I was hungover as shit and we had to go to this camp on the water. And it was just like a perfect family day.
Yep.
And I'm sitting there in a lawn chair in this my ex-wife's uncle's backyard and my daughter is at my feet playing on a blanket and I am losing my fucking mind. Because I need a drink so bad.
Yeah. Yep.
And I walked into the house and I figure I'm going to find something. And I walk in and the guy that owns the house is like, oh, you want a beer? I'm like, you got anything else?
Yeah.
He goes, I got vodka. I got blah, blah. Oh, I'll take some vodka.
Yeah.
So he goes, gets orange juice and he's going to make me a drink, but I get the vodka before he does. I said, I'll make it myself. And so I take the glass and he puts ice in it and I start pouring the vodka in. Right. And he goes, geez, God, heavy on the vodka. I'm like, oh, and I pretend I'm like, oh, shit. Oh,
right. Yeah.
And I go outside with that glass and I felt so defeated, and I sat there drinking that glass like it was like I fucking didn't have a choice because I really didn't. I started realizing I don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but here I am in this setting, this beautiful, idyllic family setting. And here I am choking down this fucking thing that owns me, right? I'm miserable. And that night, I'm in my living room and I'm doing my Wild Turkey by myself. And I've hit this dark, dark, really fucking dark place.
Now, is this affect like your family life? Is your wife, is this affecting
no,
your
you know,
life,
I was, no, she,
Cause you're a maintenance drinker.
And she grew up around it.
Yeah.
And to her, it was not a big deal. And she drank, not like I did, but she drank,
Did she remind you of your mom dealing with your dad at all? Or
kind of, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I just remember that, you know, I was.
That gets into the thinking that I do. I'm sitting here psychoanalysis.
I was having this.
I'm seeing a repeat of the cycle here.
Well, yeah, of course.
I was having this wild turkey, and I got up and I went into the bathroom, and there's this big full length mirror.
There we go.
And again, I'm in the mirror, but this time I got the drink in my hand, and I look at myself, and I'm like, "You fucking suck. Yeah, you're a piece of shit." You know, I start that, and I know a lot of us have done that.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
And I just. Inside, I'm just like crumbling, and I got like really heavy, like teary eyes. And I just remember looking up to what I don't know and saying, I don't know what to do, you know? Yeah.
Hmm. And so you went from looking at yourself to looking somewhere else.
Oh, I looked up.
Yep.
And I wasn't a God guy.
No.
I just said, I don't know what to do. And something in my head said, call AA tomorrow.
Yeah. So you knew about it.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. How did you?
Oh, yeah, let me go back to that. When I was going to say, when I was a kid, I had a friend who we used to call Spanky.
Yeah.
Who was
he
was a badass. He was a drinker, motorcycle guy, and he was fucking cool, and he was one of my best friends.
Yeah.
And his dad had a big Lincoln Continental, and on the back there was a bumper sticker that said, take it easy.
Ah.
Or no, I'm not taking it. It said, easy does it. Easy does it.
All right.
And I always saw that. I'm like, that's a fucking weird bumper sticker. And we would hang out at his house and play basketball and hang out in his garage and drink and smoke pot and stuff. And around 7:30 every night, his dad would come out and say, and this guy's name was really Dave. And he would say, Dave, I'm going to a meeting. And he'd say, okay. And he'd fire getting his, you know,
so
continental
you
and go. And so I didn't know what the fuck it was.
Yeah.
So one night we're sitting there, maybe five or six of us around in a circle drinking, and we're passing a joint around. And we hear him outside, Dave, I'm going to a meeting. And he goes, and I go, what are these meetings? And this guy was a plumber.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah.
I said, what are these meetings? He goes, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I go, what is that? He goes, it's for people that, you know, like, they drink every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't want to drink.
Loser.
And I go, well, my answer to that was, I go, well, my father drinks every day. And he's not an alcoholic.
Right.
That's how much I knew about it. And I go, so what do these do at these meetings? Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, they sit around and drink coffee and talk about drinking. And just then I was smoking a joint. I took a big hit off the joint. I'm like, I go, that's fucked up. And I give it to the next guy. And so that was my introduction to AA. And, you know.
So going back to your first meeting, so your first time walking in the door.
Well, so here's what happened with me is you know, I finished drinking that night, and the next day, my alcoholism was like, all right, dude, that was a rough night. Right. You're going to be okay. But something in me back then made me go in the phone book in the white pages and look up Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called them up, and I'm like, look, I don't know what this is, but I want to stop drinking. I think I need to. And they were like, okay, there's a meeting at this church, and here's the address. And I wrote down the address. And back then, there was no app to find it. You had to figure it out for yourself.
Yeah.
And so the next day, it's a beautiful day in July, sunny out, and I'm thinking I'm going to leave work a little early. And I start thinking, you know what? You're okay.
Yeah.
Just go to happy hour. Have a couple drinks. You're going to be fine.
That gift of desperation can be so fleeting.
Oh, my
God. It can be so – like, that's the scariest part.
Yeah.
Is if you don't catch it in that small window.
That's exactly it.
And you start to feel just a little bit better.
So here's what happened to me is I went to this church – where this meeting was, and there was no cars in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And I walked up to the door, and it was locked. And I figured, all right, this is – the world's telling me that you don't need to do this shit. But I knocked on the thing, and a janitor came out. He goes, can I help you? I go, yeah, I'm looking for the meeting. And he goes, what meeting? And I did not want to say Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
I was embarrassed.
Yeah, of course.
So I said, the meeting for people who don't really want to drink anymore. And he goes, oh, the AA meeting? It's at the church next door. And I'm like, fuck.
Shit.
So I get back in my car.
Hmm? Did you go?
Well, I get back in my car and I'm thinking, all right, this has gone far enough. I'm just going to go back to the bar where my friends are and have a couple drinks and I'm going to be okay.
And now how old are you at this point too?
I am 29. Yeah.
So you got in fairly young.
And I've got my daughter is, you know, I've got a daughter. And so I spin the car around and I'm like, I'm just going to go.
Thank God.
Still enough of that desperation, that seed.
Yeah.
And I went to this meeting, and I see all the cars, and I see all the people walking in, and I decide I'm going to walk in and say, I don't know what this is, but – and I'm walking up, and I see this guy walking down the sidewalk, a big plastic mug of coffee. And he looks to be about my age, and I'm looking lost, and he goes, hey. I go, hey. He goes, you looking for the AA meeting? I go, yeah. He goes, have you ever been to one before? Mm-hmm. I go, no. He goes, do you smoke? I'm thinking, what? I'm like, no. He goes, okay, because, you know, at the time, they smoke.
Yeah.
But it was kind of bridging over to where people who didn't want to smoke didn't want to be there, so they broke off into a non-smoke. So this guy says, stick with me, sit next to me. We do readings at first, then we break off into a non-smoking meeting. Yeah. So he goes, just break off to the non-smoking, stick with me. I'm like, fine, you know. And I'm thinking, who the fuck is this guy? You know, why is he interested in me? Mm-hmm. So we go there, we split off into the non-smoking, and the people start going around the room and telling their stories. And everybody that's telling a story is telling part of my story.
Of course.
About the desperation, the darkness, how it's out of control, how one day it's good, one day it's bad. And, you know, I mean, just everything they're saying is clicking with me. And this one guy tells a story about how he's given a newcomer a ride to a meeting. And he stops at the convenience store to get a soda, and he goes in, and the kid steals his car.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and everybody starts laughing, and I'm like, what are these people laughing about?
Yeah. You know, stuff that would horrify the general public.
There's a part of me that's kind of digging it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, okay, maybe.
That 12-year-old deviant part of you, yeah.
Right. And so the next guy raises his hand and says, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm the guy that stole this car. And everybody starts busting, roars out in laughter, and I'm like, this is kind of cool.
So you connected pretty quickly.
I connected very quickly with the people in the stories.
Yes. And then obviously you came in and stopped drinking right away, right?
Well, for that day, my sponsor after goes, where do you live? And, you know.
So you got a sponsor already?
Well, he became my sponsor.
Oh, okay.
And he's
all
like,
right.
I live right around the corner. Stop at my house. I want to give you something. I'm like, okay. Hmm. And so he gives me a big book. And he writes in the cover of the big book, hope this is the start of a great thing for you. And he puts the date and he signs it and he gives it to me. And I took it home that night and I was determined not. He said, don't drink tonight. And I gave him my number. He goes, I'm going to call you tomorrow, and we're going to go to a meeting. I'm like, okay, you know. And I go home, and I open up the stories in the back, and I start reading a couple of the stories. And I'm like, holy shit, this is me, you know. And the next day, the guy picks me up at noon, and we go to a noon meeting. And he continued to do that for months. And, you know, he starts talking about a sponsor. And then one day I was like,
yeah, you did the.
Will you be my sponsor?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah. So this guy sponsors me, takes me through the steps slowly. And I say slowly, not because of him, because of me.
Yeah.
Because during the first 6 months that I was going to meetings, what happened with me is I quit drinking for 6 days initially. And then a friend of mine called and said, hey, we're all going to so-and-so bar. Meet us out. I go, well, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous now and I'm not drinking. He goes, well, that's okay. Just come out and don't drink.
Just come out
and drink soda. Yeah. And I'm like, that's fucking brilliant.
Yes.
I've cracked the code.
So I went out and I lasted maybe 2 minutes. I ordered a soda and all that booze behind the bar and the element that was in that bar, I had no choice. I was defenseless.
You had no control.
I was defenseless. I ordered a drink and I got drunk.
Now, only in the interest of time.
Yeah.
Yes.
You did this for how long?
6 months.
6 months.
Yep. In and out.
People,
places, and things was my was my sticking point.
All right.
So let's fast forward to when it stuck.
It stuck. I was invited to go to a bowl game for a college bowl game in Atlanta, and my sponsor told me don't go. And I was going with a guy who knew I had a problem with alcohol, and he didn't drink that much. And I figured
you're safe.
Yeah. I was safe for about 2 minutes once we walked in the first place. And
did you make it,
through
the airport?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a 3-day blackout binge. It was out of control.
Some of the shenanigans, please.
Well, one of the shenanigans was it was New Year's Eve.
Yes. This is after you succumb. And
the weather
just
was beautiful, and I was on the verge of black. I was in a gray out. And
brownout, they call it.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of – no, the brownout came later when I shit my pants.
Oh,
I'm in the middle of traffic outside, and there's a big traffic jam at midnight. Everybody's honking their horns, and I'm sticking my head into cars and kissing random women that were with their husbands or boyfriends. And people wanted to kick my ass, and I was chased.
You had it coming.
I did, and I was just drunk as shit. And I remember when it was time to go home, I'm waiting in the airport for my flight, and I just, you know, it was dark, man. It was really dark, and I had a really bad hangover, but I didn't want to drink. And I'm like, I'm obviously failing at the sobriety thing. You know, I came back home. I white knuckled at home. I called my sponsor, who had just about had it with me.
Yeah, sure.
You know, he was kind of like, well, if you don't want to get sober, I'm not getting, I can't
right,
get sober.
Right, we don't chase you.
He said, I'm going to this meeting. If you want to go, show up.
Show up.
I showed up, and I was very timid and weak and defeated. And I raised my hand. I started to cry, and I was just like, I was weeping, and I was like, I don't know. I can't do this. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And people were, you know, supportive. A couple old timers were like, you know, don't fucking waste our time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, but, you know, I was, that feeling in my gut is a feeling I never wanted to have again, and I never wanted to forget. And I've never forgotten that feeling.
Yeah.
And that was, 36 years ago? 35 years?
34 years ago, yeah.
So you've been sober for 34 years?
34 years, yeah.
Why do you keep coming?
I keep coming because, I need to live a sane life. And I'll tell you what happened as part of my story is that I, after about 4 or 5 years of being sober and sponsoring other people mm-hmm. and being pretty involved, I started getting away from it. And I got down to like 2 meetings a week, then 1 meeting a week, then 1 meeting a month. Then no meetings.
Yeah.
And I would go back and get my chip. You know, my ego said, go back and get your chip, dude. You got 8 years.
Just so everybody knows, I'm still great.
Yeah. But yeah. I wasn't drinking and I didn't want to drink.
Yeah.
You know, I had the alcohol wasn't calling me. But my life and my thinking started to change, revert back to alcoholic thinking. And I started experiencing things that were very negative.
Was the anxiety still around?
No, at this point I went to a shrink.
Yeah.
And he was like, you have classic anxiety disorder, and you've had it since you were a tot. I was very lucky because at the time, a class of drugs called SSRIs, most people know it as Prozac. And he goes, some people are taking this. There's very little side effect, and it's been proven to be pretty effective, even for anxiety. It was more of a depression drug.
Selective serotonin reuptake
inhibitor. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's like, do you want to try it? And I'm like, yeah. And after about 2.5 weeks later, I had a panic attack that did not affect me. I could feel myself having it, and I was just like, this is a mothering.
Yeah, same.
And ever since then, it's been fine. I've been managing it.
Now, you do a lot of things, though. You're a meditator, aren't you?
I do. I meditate. I go to the gym. I try to do these self-care things that I'm not real good at. Self-care is not my first thought.
Yeah.
It's always a thought of, you know, like a lot of people say, I move at the speed of pain. I move at the speed of pain.
Yeah.
And so when I become uncomfortable in my life, I'm thinking, okay, I haven't been to the gym in 4 days. So my body's going, what are you doing? Prayer and meditation are big. You know, and I could spend a whole hour talking about the God thing.
Yeah.
Because like Matt, when I came
in. I could spend a lot of time talking about
the God thing. I was not into it. The thing is, I always felt there's something there. And that's why AA was so comfortable for me, was that you don't have to define it.
Yeah.
And so I came to a point of an understanding with my higher power where I just don't define it. I don't name it. I know it's there. I interact with it. I call it the universe.
I think that's why for the listener, Mark is actually my sponsor. And I think that's why at least what drew me to you initially and why we get along so well is because you haven't really forced it down my throat. You've allowed me to kind of figure out my own thing.
Right.
And
a God of your understanding.
And you've never kind of forced me to conform to somebody else's idea.
Right. But you wanted what Mark had.
I wanted
at the
what
same
he had
time,
too. Well,
of course.
I guess if we're going even deeper behind the curtain, I've actually known Mark
since
I was a kid. I played hockey with his son, and we used to go on trips. We used to go on we used to go to hockey trips, and all the parents would drink, and then he would take all the kids kind of into a room, and we would play blackjack. But as a kid, I didn't realize this guy's not drinking. I was like, he just really loves hanging out with us kids, man.
He's a pedophile. This guy's a pedophile.
Yeah. Why is he always hanging around us?
Yeah, I always found a way to not drink.
Yeah.
I got into a spot in my life where shit was going off the rails. And my first thought was, I know what's missing. I need to go back to AA because I didn't realize this at the time. AA is my design for living.
Right.
And I got away from that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And without a design for living, it became self-will run riot.
Drinking is such a small part of
that. It is. Drinking is, and people say alcohol is but a symptom of our dilemma, you know, and. Another thing I was thinking about, too, was a lack of power is our dilemma. I remember hearing that, and it's so true for me every day still. If I try to exert my self-will, I will become a very unhappy person very quickly. Anxiety, anger, all those things. I got to let it go, man.
Yeah.
And just, you know, figure the universe is going to take care of me.
It has.
And it never has failed me.
Yeah.
You think it would be my go-to, but it is not.
No.
Self-will is my go-to, you know. And when it becomes painful and apparent enough, I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute, this isn't reality. Reality is that, you know, I am but a part of the universe. And the more I work with that and realize that and act accordingly, the more serene my life is. The better the outcomes.
Yeah.
The better the outcomes. The outcomes aren't necessarily what I thought I wanted, but in the end, they always work for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, serenity.
You know? And, you know, there's a message I'd like to give people.
I was just going to ask you. We don't give advice, but what would you—
Right. You know, the key to the program is one day at a time.
Yep.
I will say that. It is one day at a time. Anytime you are freaked out and the anxiety levels are high, bring yourself back to one day at a time. It works for me. And the other thing is that surrender is essential.
Oh, I agree.
Not just with alcohol, but surrendering to the reality that— The universe is in charge.
And it's not me.
It's not me.
I hate that surrender to win, which is usually a good idea.
And it's so true.
Usually if I hate something,
yeah.
It means it's something
exactly.
I should be doing.
Right. If I recoil from it, it's probably true.
Yeah. All right. So. Well, Mark, thank you so much for and Brett, thank you for allowing me to sit in on this.
Of course.
But until next time, I'm Matt.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Mark. As we wrap up another episode of the Glum Lot Podcast, we want to extend our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in today. Navigating the path to recovery from alcohol and other substances is a journey filled with challenges, triumphs, and self-discovery. Remember, we're not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're here to provide a safe space for open conversations about the complexities of recovery. Your stories, courage, and resilience inspire us and our listeners alike. If you or someone you know is on the transformative journey, know that you're not alone. Join us next time as we continue to explore the diverse facets of recovery. Until then, stay strong, stay connected, and remember that each day is a step towards a brighter, sober tomorrow. Thank you for being part of the Glum Lot community.